I'm Tony Hendro.
And I'm Jeff Chrysler.
And this is the Final Edition Radio Hour.
30 minutes of sizzling satire with teeth.
My fellow Americans, I want to talk to you about Syria. I believe in both a limited strike and diplomacy. I'm the first president ever to make the case for both war and peace in the same speech. And I assure you, I'm not high. You know how movies are based on a true story? My foreign policy is now based on John Kerry's off-the-cuff remarks. I'm taking credit for those, hoping to turn them into on-the-cuff remarks. Russia is helping us, despite my best efforts to snub them over Edward Snowden, who, by the way, is probably tweeting about this in a Moscow Starbucks. President Putin wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times in which he rebutted my belief that Americans are exceptional. I'd like to remind Putin that if Americans actually were exceptional, I wouldn't have to tell them they were in the first place. Americans spent every night this week watching Ryan Seacrest host a derivative game show called The Million Second Quiz. How exceptional is that? History will judge us, and by history, I mean the upcoming season of Newsroom. I hope my handling of this crisis will be worthy of a dramatic arc and not background to a comic subplot involving Allison Pill. I know that Americans are war-weary and would rather focus on issues like unemployment, education, and Miley Cyrus. But please, give my policy a chance to work on the off chance that I actually get one. Thank you, and God bless my approval rating.
And now, another episode of Oh, That George, starring George Zimmerman, the lovable little scamp who can be excused for anything, no matter what kind of mischief he gets into. As our story opens, George is being released from custody after his ex-wife said he threatened her with a gun and punched her father in the face.
Well, your wife changed her story, so it looks like you're free to go spread your infectious joy throughout the world. Do photo ops at gun shows.
Thanks, Officer Tom. Boy, women sure can be a lot of trouble.
Yeah, but what are you gonna do?
Oh, I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna be ready, Tom. I'm gonna be armed and ready. And then I'm gonna walk away clean, just like always.
Oh, George.
Later at the 911 dispatch.
Oh, no. There's been an accident with an SUV. I'm calling my friend George to come over and rescue them. Maybe that'll fix his reputation. Oh, here he comes now.
I am a silent guardian, a watchful protector, a dark knight.
It was probably self-defense.
Come here, punk!
Three weeks ago, Bradley Manning was sentenced by Judge Denise Lind to 35 years in a military prison at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. 6 days ago, Chelsea Manning, as Manning wants now to be known, applied for a presidential pardon, commuting his sentence to 3 years. The Army reacted negatively, unsurprisingly, but the Final Edition, in a world exclusive, has discovered that Judge Lind visited with Chelsea a few days ago to explain why she received a sentence seemingly so out of proportion to her, or, as it then was, his supposed crimes.
Good morning, Chelsea. I thought I would take this opportunity to explain my reasoning about your sentence. You see, fundamentally, it's nothing to do with your leaking documents that would eventually be declassified anyway. Here's how the sentence worked. 1 year for being absolutely right about torture. 1 year for rubbing our noses in just how brutal, inhuman, and useless torture is. 1 year for making the American people feel rotten about themselves for a nanosecond or two. And since I think the court spoke for all Americans in this matter, another year for that. And another. 1 year for making us look bad to the rest of the world. And another year for making us look worse to the rest of the world than they already think we are. 1 year for making us look even worse to the rest of the world than the Bush administration already had. 1 year for being gay. Another for that. And another. 1 year for being a girly boy crybaby and not a good soldier. And another for that. 1 year for not being a good soldier and blindly following orders. And another for that. 1 year for not being a good soldier and turning a deaf ear to everything except orders. And another for that. 1 year for not being a good soldier and dumbly following orders. And another for that. 1 year because we all know in our heart of hearts that Bush and Cheney and their gang of neocons are genocidal murderers who will never pay for their massive crimes. But that someone has to. And it may as well be you. And another year for that. And another. And finally, 1 year for making it clear beyond a shadow of a doubt that we were responsible in that war for more than 1 million Iraqi deaths, though our media is always obediently saying that there were just tens of thousands. And we don't want to know that, Chelsea. But we do. And you're why. And another for that. And another and another. Oh, and one more for wanting to be called Chelsea. I know it's considered chic in Oklahoma, kid, but you couldn't do better than that. Taylor, Mackenzie, Jessica, Apple. And whatever that total is, I'm making it up to 35, so you won't get out or be able to hook up with anyone until you're 60. And think about this, Miss Goody Two-Shoes. Now you're safely locked away with your girly boy hormone treatments and America's feeling fine again and is already forgetting about you. We can turn our attention to thinking about, just thinking about, bombing yet another Muslim Mideastern country full of squabbling Sunnis and Shiites. So long, Chelsea. America thanks you for taking the fall.
This is Tony Hendra. You're listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour. Visit thefinaledition.com every day for more sizzling satire with teeth.
And now it's time for Miles the Millennial, Episode 3, Miles, Media Darling.
Hello, Miles, old sport. How are they hanging?
Hello, Head Boomer. They're hanging low, thank you.
First Boomer, Second Boomer, Third Boomer, and I were just having lunch and comparing our retirement plans and the huge pensions we've amassed. And wonderful, wonderful Obamacare, which is going to keep us alive for decades.
Which your taxes will pay for, Miles.
For all those long years we go on living.
And we were wondering, Miles, if you're being a smart little millennial and planning for the future.
Are you tucking a little away, Miles, every week?
Starting a little nest egg?
Well, I'd like to, but it's kind of hard on the federal minimum, and...
Miles, you ingrate!
Are you seriously bitching about your pay packet?
You're only an intern.
Lower than the belly of a snake.
Lower than the belly of a bug on the belly of a snake.
Guys, I'm really sorry. I'm not ungrateful. I love working at BoomerNet.
Did you know the word intern derives from the word internet?
No, it doesn't.
And no one ever makes any money on the internet.
Hence, intern. One who makes no money for his work on the internet.
I should get back to my work, if that's okay.
Were you paid at your last job, Miles?
Oh, no, but the CEO was this cool geek my age who made $1 billion in gaming software and had a Lamborghini and his own island in the Bahamas.
What the fuck
has that got to do
with getting paid?
He was a cool dude like me, so I was cool with getting paid in pizza.
You're such an idiot, Miles.
Millennials are all utter idiots.
Which is why we don't trust anyone under 30.
Make that 50.
Did this awesome geek give you any stock, Miles?
No, just pizza. I don't know why you guys are always tormenting me. You must be really pissed at me.
You know why we're pissed at you, Miles, old sport? Deep, deep down. Because although we have all the power and most of the money...
Studios, networks, cable channels, and the ad agencies that depend on them are run by Gen Xers.
Who are losing their hair or their figures or haven't had a baby yet.
And who all long to be young again.
Like you, Miles. So they target their movies and TV shows and ad campaigns at millennials who have no power or money.
or as far as we can tell, taste.
But are young and occasionally pretty.
Just as they once were.
We're pissed at the Gen Xers for making no films, no TV shows, no cool ads for us, even though we do 80% of the buying which keeps them financially alive. And we blame you for that, Miles.
That's not fair.
We realize it's not fair. Or logical, Miles.
Because we're older and far wiser than you.
But we don't care.
So we're going to continue giving you an incredibly hard time, Miles.
But why? What have I done?
Because
we can!
And according to our attorneys, there are no laws against blatant generational discrimination.
And there won't be in the foreseeable future because we have all the political power.
You have no political power, Miles.
Unless, of course, we decide to pass laws to make discriminating against an older generation a felony.
And we just might do that.
To stop Gen Xers discriminating against us with the movies and TV shows.
They make for you, Miles.
Glee makes us puke.
The new normal is anything but.
We tolerate Modern Family because it has a boomer in it.
Blatant tokenism.
Frankly, the only Mindy project we'd watch would be projecting Mindy out of a 30-story window.
So you see, Miles, it's your fault. We're so pissed.
Because we're getting pretty fucking tired of watching reruns of Maud and All in the Family and Sanford and Son.
Taxi.
Twilight Zone.
Green Acres.
I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles.
It's time for the final edition Radio Hour's very first interview featuring Ellen Stein, author of the latest book about the National Lampoon, entitled That's Not Funny, That's Sick. Our own Tony Hendra, who was an original editor of The Lampoon, as well as producer of its Grammy-winning first two albums and its off-Broadway hit Lemmings, interviews Ellen.
This is the final edition Radio Hour with its first interview. We have with us today Ellen Stein, who is the author or authoress of the latest Lampoon and possibly most definitive Lampoon book, That's Not Funny, That's Sick. And I am possibly going to interview Ellen Stein, or possibly Ellen Stein's going to interview me, which she never did for this book, even though I was at the Lampoon.
I can explain why.
Okay.
You were busy finishing your book.
Right.
Going Too Far, available at all good bookstores. And so you didn't want to be interviewed for the book.
That's absolutely true. And I
would have loved to have had you.
I was trying to get away with it, but obviously I can't. But one of the things I do just want to say to our listeners, there have been several books about the National Lampoon, and most of them follow the same rough chronology that I established in Going Too Far, which was the first account of the National Lampoon from 1970 to its to the beginning of its decline in the early 80s. Most of them have also tended to focus on the various peccadilloes and quarrels and feuds and so on at the Lampoon, with a kind of relish that seems completely out of place for a magazine that's now 40 years old. But Ellen's is most in fact, Ellen, I should say it to you. I mean, what really impresses me about the book is that you've set the Lampoon in its historical context, and not only that, but you. Finally, I mean, I think there have been sort of hints of this earlier, but finally you set the Lampoon down as an enormous influence on American comedy in the latter half of the 20th century.
The internal dynamics are there because you have to explain why things evolved the way they did. But what was really interesting to me is the context, the larger context, and also I mean, so much the material stands up because one of the reasons I looked at it from 1970 to 1980 was because that's when it was in its heyday, and after that it became a product as opposed to sort of more creative expression that for
right.
some just managed to, for various reasons, which I hope I outline, become commercial by sheer luck almost. It's a way of looking at the 70s, which is very often dismissed as you know, disco swinging and oil crisis, that's it.
And self-indulgence and the me decade and all that stuff.
And that sort of swinging.
Right. which I think actually from a, I mean, I've always felt, well, obviously I have a certain vested interest in this, but I mean, I've always felt the 70s actually were a period of great sort of opening up.
That's what I was about to say. I was really looking at how the 60s turned into the 80s, and a lot of the sort of fault lines in culture and politics that we're still arguing about now started then. And the Lampoon, you know, without waving a flag on one side or the other, explored these. And so a lot of the material, which stands up incredibly well, that there was that piece in the politics issue about ultra-right. It was a parody of the ultra-right commercial, and it had Nelson Rockefeller, of course, was the now deceased Reed, the liberal Republican or moderate Republican,
right,
saying, "One day overheard a top leader in my party. You wouldn't know his name in a million years, but he's on the board of 147 top corporations. Say to a mediocre party warhorse, 'Too bad Nelson's such a goddamn pinko. What do you say we give him the old heave-ho?' He recommended ultra-right. All it is a powerful mixture of blatant racism and crude fear enhancers combined with simple-minded rhetoric. In just weeks, convictions I had held for 20 years were gone, and with them that low-key washed-up feeling that could accompany defeat in a major election." So I was editing this book for publication during the primaries in 2012.
Nothing's happened since 1972.
Could have come right out of his candidate's mouth, I thought.
Yes, yes, absolutely. No, I mean, I think that's very much the case. And I mean, in the sense that people seem to have forgotten that, for example, the 70s were the absolute, probably the best period that Hollywood ever went through. I mean, 70s movies, one of them, but I mean, certainly far better than the 60s and far better than the 80s. I mean, wonderful movies were made in the 70s, not just the obvious ones like Godfather. So, I mean, the culture as a whole gets very short.
We'll make an exception for Spinal Tap in the 80s, of course.
Right. Oh, another movie you didn't actually talk about very much.
I mentioned it, but it's sort of out of the... I really had to be disciplined about stopping at 1980 because that book is long enough.
But I mean, now that we're together, I mean, actually, it seems to me Spinal Tap, not only in terms of personnel, but in terms of sort of continuation of things that the Lampoon obviously explored first, like rock parody, was an outgrowth of it just as much as Saturday Night
Live. It's a whole other book.
That's an idea.
Not just a footnote.
Maybe we should do it together.
Not just a tiny, you know, sort of tiny couple of paragraphs in mine, but a whole other thing unto itself. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, you have, you know, been working with this satire coalface man and boy.
Right.
And do you think its audience has gotten bigger? I mean, you know, I get memes on Facebook every day. They're actually quite pointed and good. And has it gotten more diffuse and it's even less relevant? Or is it more The Daily Show? You know, is it more relevant?
I tend to be a little bit of a fundamentalist about satire when it comes to the definition of satire. But because I think satire is a timeless form, which needs to be properly defined, and without getting into that right now because that's kind of boring and academic, I think there are many different things that pass for satire would have satirical intention. For example, I would describe my great friend and I think comedic genius George Carlin as a satirist in just the same way that Juvenal was a satirist. I mean, the way that the sort of slashing surveys of his, you know, contemporaneous life are sort of satirical in the most ancient sense. But I think a lot of things pass as satire, but have the effect that satire ought to have. So, I mean, it seems to me that in the 2008 election, and actually in the last election, the presidential election, I mean, Tina Fey and what she did to Sarah Palin was classic satire in action. And it affected the outcome of the election, no question.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wrote a long essay at the time for some academic journal, a right-wing one, actually, called Keene Magazine, with Keene University in New Jersey. But it was about the fact that Obama seemed to be, even more than Reagan, completely unassailable. But he didn't give them any edge to peel up. Whereas the McCain and Palin were just insane. I mean, and you cannot, ultimately, you cannot get elected when almost everything you say has a laugh track applied to it, you know. But I mean, that's an interesting point in general, because I do think that satire which I define as something much more like Colbert. To me, is much more of a satirist than Stuart, because he adopts the position and mentality of his enemy, of his target, and that's really what great satire does. It's what Jonathan Swift does. That's what Dr. Strangelove does. I mean, all the great sort of high points of satire. To me, that's the most admirable when you can do that.
The other thing is, I mean, I do spend a lot of time in the book on a couple of your post-Lampoon projects, which I thought, in a way, not the New York Times had even more of an impact than a lot of Lampoon articles.
Yes, I must thank you for that. I've tended to be kind of mushed into the general, it was all such fun.
No,
And it was an incredibly difficult thing to do. Mm. And it did actually, after all the experience I had at the Lampoon as an editor, for which I also thank you, because that was really what I was very good at. I was not a bad writer, but I was a really good editor, and I collaborated really well with people. So this was my opportunity to sort of shine as Rusty Younger said, as the editor in chief.
Yeah.
And it was God, it was exciting. It was such fun too.
It was funny.
Oh, it was very funny. I mean, I still go back and read Carl Bernstein, of all people, you know. Pope dies yet again. Reign is briefest ever. Cardinals return from airport. I mean, that was George Plimpton. He and I wrote that headline together at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And also the lifestyle section was what really cracked me up. The funniest headline was, cocaine, in quotes, a drug, appears popular.
Right.
That's the New York Times to a T right there.
Right, and then they had the graphic of the increasing number of noses from 1978, whatever it was. You know.
One thing I wanted to use the book to do is to, it isn't a soup to nuts history of Lampoon. I said it starts
at
all, ends in 1980. All these people who really liked it in 1980 have written in saying, wait, we didn't do this and that. Different book. I also wanted to use it to sort of shine a light on some other things that were happening that were related, maybe tangentially related, or that Lampoon people worked on, or that fed into Lampoon in some way, that have, I think, been forgotten to some extent, and some extent unfairly forgotten. But the other thing that I wanted to sort of, that I spent a lot of time on, because I liked it, so is the 80s, a look back. And that, so many of those, especially Jeff Greenfield, so many of those articles are so prescient. This was a book, an 80s look back, came out in 1979, correct?
Mm-hmm. January the 31st, 1979.
And it was like what happened during the 80s. So this was written around 1979, and Jeff Greenfield cites a Supreme Court decision which states that, quote, corporations may spend any amount of money to influence the outcome of public referenda, and that individuals may spend any amount of money to elect themselves to office. We take judicial notice of the fact that money talks. This was satire, ho-ho, like this could happen. And then it did.
Yes, actually, that's absolutely true. You actually list many of the things that did actually come true in one way or another. Mm. And, of course, we had to wait 30 years for the Congress of Nuts, too. But we finally got that.
And the amicus fiti brief.
Right.
Again, unthinkable, but...
One of the things that I also liked about the book was that you didn't... First of all, that you concentrated on the material, because the material is the one thing that has sort of been forgotten. And it shouldn't be, because, as you say, much of it holds up. And there was nothing like it before or since that I know of. I mean, you cite the Vietnamese Baby book, for example, which is a piece I actually had to make O'Donoghue dig out of his drawer. This was a book that was called the Vietnamese Baby book, and it was a baby book in all its beautiful sugary saccharine little bows and kisses everywhere, except that the baby in question was one of the babies that had been killed at or injured at My Lai. And so baby's first word was medic, and baby's first toy was a bandage, and so forth and so on. And it was a devastating piece of satire, actually, a genuine piece of satire.
And the thing about the Lampoon also that was interesting is that it was different from things that had gone before, like, say, for example, The Realist, because the production values were very good. It was not totally glossy, but the attention to detail and Michael Gross in the art department, the artwork, so the parodies, all the details of parodies, even down to like sort of personal ads. incredible attention to detail, and saying things always looked like whatever it was they were parodying. And I think that's one of the things that made it very different.
Well, yes, I think actually that's the same dynamic that I'm talking about with satire. I mean, I don't think parody is the same as satire. Parody is when you when you take on the style and so forth, coloration and obsessions and so on of your target, whereas satire is what we've already defined. But it was a very strict discipline, and it was one which made us, I think, much sharper than we were given credit for, because we insisted that everything, that you couldn't make fun, as I think Michael Gross said, you can't make fun of a postage stamp unless it's actually looks exactly like a postage stamp, and then it becomes literally 10 times funnier. Which is why all those parodies, the Pet House was one of my favorites, with all these incredible sexy
of
cats,
puppies, yes,
with Vaseline on the lens and stuff, just wonderful stuff. But it was really accurate, all the little quirks of design and so forth were picked up on, the logo and Guccione and all that stuff.
So funny, that it was a professionalism to it, I think, is what. What is the point to it? And the other thing about satire in the classical sense, and this was, I think, one that the Lampoon wrestled with, because some of it did, some of it didn't, the classical definition aims to instruct, and amusement is a byproduct, as opposed to aiming to amuse, and any instruction is a byproduct.
Right.
So would you say that was a dynamic that existed?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it was, and I think there's actually a funny kind of reflex that satirists have had in the modern era, mainly perhaps because of this worry about being called pretentious or whatever, but which is they always sort of discount or disown that intention. As I think you mentioned, the Beyond the Fringe people, who was, at least in English terms, started all this, were always saying we're not satirists. We're just sort of poking fun at things in a good-hearted way. But in fact, what they were doing, especially in the wonderful piece by Alan Bennett of Church of England Sermon, which is just extraordinary, was out-and-out satire. I mean, satire in the classic way. He takes on the character of his target and destroys it. And just in the same way, I think a lot of people at the Lampoon kind of were nervous about claiming that they actually had I never was, frankly, because that was always my purpose, was to try and change things. I mean, in Father Joe, I explain how Father Joe was my Benedictine mentor. And I explain how I came out of Beyond the Fringe. I went in a monk, and I came out a satirist. And I said to myself, save the world through prayer? I don't think so. I'm going to save it through laughter. And you can see how effective it's been.
Yes, I was thinking about the satiric cabarets of the Weimar Republic that did so much to stop the rise of Nazi Germany.
Yes, exactly. Wonderful. I mean, I think it seems to me extremely hard to do real satire on television. It doesn't matter how officially tolerant television gets. It ultimately, at the end of the day, there is always a corporate sponsor. Or there is some kind of corporate presence behind it, because it can't function otherwise. And I unfortunately think that's increasingly the case on the internet too. So that
I was going to ask you, do you think that that's one of the things also I look at, is how things don't happen in a vacuum, and the media context affects the material, and that you see that in Saturday Night Live, that we go into that a lot, where they weren't. It wasn't the sponsors came down and said, oh, you can't do that. But nevertheless, there's always a faint hint of this. And do you think that, as Michael Shamberg said, that once the production costs are so much lower now because of, accessible technology, and there's so many more ways of distribution and fewer gatekeepers, do you think that there is more kind of genuine satire out there as a result, or because they don't have these pressures you just mentioned?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, but that's obviously purely personal, because there is so much, video and so forth out there that it's impossible to review at all. And I do think that there are several things militating against it. One is that there are successful corporately owned or run so-called satire sites like Funny or Die and College Humor, which were neither of which are satirical, but both of which are sort of heavy-duty corporate enterprises. Mm. I mean,
they assume that sort of tone, but their message.
Yes, as I said once about Saturday Night, the sound but not the fury.
Yeah.
And that seems to me to be. To be a problem because they're kind of sucking all the oxygen out of the internet, if you like, all the satirical oxygen.
Except for the final edition.
Well, no, the final edition has no sponsors, and therefore, and also has no distribution. Mm. But we're gradually sort of building it up.
Yet.
And I think the Onion, I think the Onion has a kind of, I
love
the Onion, and the Onion, when I first met them, were great enough and generous enough to say, we owe everything to the Lampoon, which was like the first time I'd ever heard anyone say that, which was in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And they said that's all we wanted to do, was to do something like the National Lampoon. And the Lampoon had sponsors, too. So, I mean, there comes a point where...
It's always a trade-off.
Yeah. Mm. But I think in the Lampoon, there was a time, anyway, we just didn't care.
Yes.
And we were successful enough, like we were talking under the sponsors to our audience.
Well, it's a rare confluence of circumstances.
Sure.
And that's what I wanted to look at. Why that? Why did it work and why then?
Yes. And I think you very successfully created that sort of sense of time. But I also, as you say, I think one of the things that is tremendously fun and interesting and fascinating about this book, provided you have like some minuscule modicum of historical sense and knowledge, is that a lot of this stuff holds up because it's the issues that were aborning in the 70s have not gone away, and nor have they been resolved.
Yeah, no, that's why this material is so,
right.
so strong.
It's the last book standing when it comes to The Lampoon, too, which is probably, I doubt if another book is going to come out about The Lampoon.
We hope not.
We hope not.
There have been more than
we Lampooners certainly hope not. But it's... But I do. I think one thing is interesting, which is worth stating before we finish, because I think that the one really big change that has happened in the last 20 years or so, 20 to 30 years, is that the rise of what I once called entrepreneurial comedy has made, meaning stand-up comedy, which has sort of fragmented the comedic world into literally thousands and thousands of voices, is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a collective kind of humor that in which there were definitely stars emerged.
Mm. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Right. So I think that sort of militates against it too. And even though you have practitioners like Carlin and a few of his followers who are still around, it's a form which has conditioned people to be. Not to be too receptive to this.
Rugged individuals.
Right. But I think that's another reason why the book is really fascinating, and because it does it evokes the 70s and the late 60s on such a kind of multi-level, in such a multi-level way. So anyway, I mean, I'm very, very pleased you wrote the book.
Oh,
and
I'm so
very
glad to hear it.
Very, very unhappy now that I didn't get interviews because. I think you take your revenge on me just a tiny bit.
I did ask several times.
But,
I
don't think I was quite as angry as you seem to think I was.
It's not what I could only go by what people told me. Maybe your bark was worse than your bite.
No, I think so. Anyway, Ellen Stein, thank you so much for coming
my
by
pleasure.
And visiting
thank
the final edition radio. Huh?
Thank you so much.
And we could not have kicked off our interview section, which we intend to do quite often, in a better way.
Good.
That was Tony Hendra with Ellen Stein. Her book, That's Not Funny, That's Sick, is on sale at Amazon and all surviving actual bookstores now. You should get it because it is great. And that does it for another edition of the Final Edition Radio Hour. Tonight's episode was performed by Barry Lank, Rob Gordon, Rachel Rausch, Kevin Janis, and Tony Hendra. It was written by Barry Lank and Tony Hendra. Get on over to thefinaledition.com for more sizzling satire with teeth. And while you're there, look for details on how you can purchase our very first album, The Vinyl Edition. The Final Edition Radio Hour was produced by Jeff Kreisler and Tony Hendra, engineered by Jason Taubenfeld and Giselle Hernandez, and edited by Greg Russ. The Final Edition Radio Hour is a production of The Final Edition, LLC, copyright 2013.